against the Burlington Area Schools. Hold on, Mr. Nunnery, until your adversaries at least manage to find their table. Please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. First, I want to highlight what I consider certain very important facts in this case. One, Mr. Peterson and Dr. Martinez knew on November 19, 1998, that they were potential targets of the conspiracy. Secondly, Dr. Martinez knew that there was a civil injunction prohibiting MR from coming to the school district. Superintendent Gianduras had no evidence and no way to evaluate any evidence as to whether MR continued to be a threat to staff and students. One other important point I want to highlight, whether MR participated in the plot versus his conduct. What the defendant seeks to articulate here, and in a number of their responses, particularly proposed findings of fact 109, Dr. Martinez was unable to give Superintendent Gianduras the name of any student or staff that MR ever threatened or intended to threaten. What they say in their response, RO 49, the defendant's response in this matter is that the defendant disputes this finding on the grounds that Superintendent Gianduras testified that Dr. Martinez did give Superintendent Gianduras names of specific targets of the plot which MR participated, but merely did not have the names of targets that MR had specifically identified.
So, Mr. Nunnery, I would like you, if you wouldn't mind, to focus on your procedural argument, because the points you're making now go to whether, in fact, at the end there was a decision that you would regard as accurate. But it's hard for me to see how someone's procedural due process rights have been violated if the person is given notice, given an opportunity to appear, and that individual chooses not to appear.
And
we have plenty of cases that say that the opportunity is enough.
That is correct. And I believe at the end of the day that this court will find that that is irrelevant. What the court did below, and we cited this in R 49, Exhibits 20 and 19, procedurally, the effect of this matter was to preclude MR from ever getting an education again. It was
That's a substantive argument. Are you giving up your procedural?
No, I'm not giving that up. But what I'm saying is this. There were two principal cases, Judge Reynolds and Judge Stadmuller in this case. They had an argument where a student was expelled permanently. Judge Stadmuller and Judge Reynolds agreed that this court under Lamb and Betts required that for procedural due process, there be an evaluation of rehabilitative evidence and mitigating evidence. So if you go through the process and you don't even evaluate that anyway, procedurally, that didn't happen. Then the subsequent letters goes out requesting a rehearing, suggesting to the board, look, this is what has been said in the Seventh Circuit. MR was not allowed to present mitigating evidence. MR was not allowed to present rehabilitative evidence.
Well, he could have, though, if he'd gone to the first hearing.
Then what we're also saying, what they had done, we admitted he could go to the first hearing. We admitted that, and Judge Stadmuller said that. But look at the circumstances. Look at the time and manner. The situation here of the parents undergoing all of this confusion, a TRO is out there. What should have been appropriate, there should have been a motion for leave from the circuit court to allow him to go there. So what the defendants say now, look, we sent a fax letter. He still could have come. But he was on a court order not to come. So technically, he could have walked in there, violated the order, but there was still no leave from the lower court allowing him to go there. More importantly, the inherent bias that existed in this case, we believe that it was absolutely abundant. So even if there's a procedural due process violation and the abundance of the bias by Mr. Martinez in specific, and we go to particular proposed findings of fact 96, exhibit 33, Mr. Martinez, as of November 18th, when you were speaking to Mr. Rose, by him just simply withdrawing from the school, you would not have had the assurance that he would someday subsequently reapply. That's true. One of your purposes and goal in mind was to assure that he not become a student in the Burlington Area School District. At that time, that was one of my purposes. So his bias started then. He was the target of the plot.
But he wasn't the decision maker.
He was not the decision maker, but he was the one presenting the evidence.
Right.
He presented, and he also...
Why is this any different from what happens in a criminal prosecution?
But this
prosecutor would say, my objective is to make sure this person is locked up. That doesn't mean there's any bias or that one can't get a hearing.
This court has adopted the standard articulated in Brewer. And what this court said in Brewer, absent the showing of any actual bias, then that's okay that the prosecutor would do that. What was his bias? What was the bias of Mr. Martinez? He did not reveal certain valuable evidence. He knew, for example, that he wasn't going to be charged with the crime. He could not identify any specifics of any act of conduct that MR had done himself. And also, that bias, we think, was very, very, very
critical. Even in a criminal trial, we do not require the prosecutor to place before the jury evidence favoring the defendant. There's a rule that says you can't conceal it from the other party, but you're not arguing here that evidence was concealed from the child. He knew what his own circumstances were.
That is correct. But what is fundamentally before the court is this. Does procedural due process in the context of school expulsions require the examination of mitigating and rehabilitation?
The Supreme Court has said something considerably less than in a criminal trial, and yet you're arguing for a duty that is not applicable even in a criminal trial.
I'm not denoting it as a duty. What I'm saying is what this court has said in Lamb, mitigating evidence should be offered. Judge Thad Mueller, in the case that he did in Exhibit 19, R20, said just as a matter of fundamental fairness, single isolated incidents of violence cannot result in this kind of expulsion. The putting him out to the year 2003 placed him before a single isolated incident at best, no prior acts of physical violence, equating this to the same kind of permanent expulsion that he's rejected before. And the other important fact in this case, and I don't want to miss this, and that is MR had no other alternatives to education. He received no additional public education whatsoever.
Well, he didn't receive any subsidized education. There was no limitation in this order restricting private education, was there?
No limitation on private education, and the Constitution would not address that anyway. But clearly, can the taking of his right to an education in this fashion, are there any outer boundaries?
I don't understand what right to education means. You're arguing for a right to a subsidized education.
No, I agree, and in my brief, there is no fundamental right to an education. What we're saying is...
We're just not arguing about right to education, because you agree... There's no restriction on his ability to get an education. What you're arguing is that there is a right to a subsidized education.
A public education. Thank you, and I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Nunnery. Mr. Moser.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to address the procedural due process issues raised first and then follow up with the substantive due process issues. I won't specifically address the types of procedures that are required under the Seventh Circuit and federal case law or under the Wisconsin statutes, because I believe at this point it's not disputed that all of those procedures took place. All of the notice procedures, all of the minutes procedures, everything that was required, I think it's undisputed, was given procedurally.
But Mr. Mosher, you seem to have an interesting theory, which is that when a court issues an injunction, somebody who is a party to the proceeding in which the injunction was issued can write other people and say, oh, never mind about the injunction. We aren't going to worry about it. And injunctions don't even issue unless the court has made a public interest finding. The public also has an interest in injunctions. So I'm not sure where these fact letters and all the rest have any weight at all.
Sure. Let me address the TRO issue. And I think that there are at least four reasons why the TRO isn't an impediment to the proper attendance and to the due process procedures that are required here. And first, I'll address the letters as you've raised them. The letter to counsel, which was authored by, I don't want to talk about myself in the third person, so I'll say me, stated that the district had specifically invited MR to attend the hearing. They wanted the hearing to be in a comfortable place. But more importantly, it stated that...
But it was on school district property,
it was
right?
On school
and
district
there was
property.
Nothing in the TRO that said... This applies unless the school district invites you, or language
it didn't.
To that effect.
What the TRO stated, and actually it wasn't the TRO at this point, it was the extended TRO, and I'll get to that in a second, mm-hmm. But what the extended TRO said was that this restraining order would apply as long as the student was suspended and for the length of any future expulsion. And what we wrote in the letter to counsel that day was the point that attendance at this hearing was consistent, or at least didn't violate the TRO, because as of that evening, the suspension was over. The suspension could not continue past that date. Either he would be expelled, and that would be situation one, or he wouldn't be expelled, and then all bets were off. So the TRO technically was enforced up to the point of that hearing, and that's the point that we raised in inviting MR to be at the school. The second reason that we would argue that the TRO does not apply is that MR's attorney contacted us, again, in this flurry of faxes, and informed us that no one would be attending the hearing. And it was for reasons unrelated to the TRO.
Did he ever object on the ground that he could not attend without being in violation of the TRO?
No, there's no evidence of that in the record. And, in fact, the issue of the TRO came up only after, well after these issues arose. Issue three, which Mr. Nunnery has attested, is that MR admitted in response to proposed findings of fact that nothing did prevent him from attending the hearing. And fourth,
I'm
and again...
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Where did he say that? This was in at summary judgment, the Eastern District of Wisconsin required proposed findings of fact, and the opposing side has to either challenge them or leave them admitted. One of the proposed findings of fact that we offered was that nothing prevented MR from attending the hearing, and that was one that was admitted. On top of that, and perhaps more importantly, is that nothing was submitted on MR's behalf. Even if MR couldn't go there, certainly either of his attorneys at the time could have attended, his mother could have attended, anyone in the world could have attended to present evidence, or evidence could have been sent by letter. There was certainly an opportunity under the due process procedures for any type of mitigating evidence or any type of presentation to be made. My last comment on the TRO is the fact that it wasn't the original TRO, it was an extended TRO. And that TRO was stipulated to by the parties through their attorneys. And the reason for that was because on November 29th, the next day, November 30th, was a preliminary injunction hearing that was scheduled in state court.
But you're not saying that it was any the less a court order just because you stipulated.
No, but it was stipulated to be extended. It was still an extension of that court order, but it was done by the stipulation of the parties.
I remember that, but I just don't know why that matters.
Okay, well, I will move on. Okay. Unless there are any other questions on the impact of the TRO. Okay. His failure to attend and failure to take advantage of this opportunity does constitute a waiver, as Your Honor suggested, and we've listed extensive case law that suggests that the failure to take advantage of the opportunity to present evidence or to present your argument is a waiver in the future. And the response or the suggestion by appellants that motions for reconsideration should somehow reopen the door, that's simply not supported by case law. The second argument that's made on the procedural due process grounds is the bias of Principal Martinez. And a number of the arguments were raised by the panel, but to summarize a couple of arguments on that, again, Principal Martinez was presenting the case analogous to a prosecutor doing so. His role was limited to the prosecutorial function, and he wasn't a decision maker. Even if he had been a decision maker or advising the decision makers, this court in Lamb said that that was okay. It's okay for one party, in that case it was an attorney, to be the prosecutor and then to advise the decision makers who were making the decision. But on this record, there's been no evidence suggested that the decision makers, the school board members, were biased. All that's required under Seventh Circuit case law is that the decision makers be open-minded. And here there's no evidence to suggest that they were not open-minded. And on top of that, the Greer case...
It was a pretty charged atmosphere, though, was it not? Wasn't there a meeting the next day or so in the community where... I mean, Burlington's not the biggest town in Wisconsin. Some 1,500 people showed up.
Yeah, and, Your Honor, it doesn't take a big town to make an issue like this charged. But I think it would be unfair to put a burden on a school board just because... The reason that the issue was charged was because of the actions that MR and its co-conspirators took. And I don't think that there should be any advantage to that person from procedural due process grounds just because he was the one who instigated the ruckus that occurred in the community and the ruckus that maintained in the community for a long time. So yes, Your Honor, it was a charged atmosphere, but that shouldn't impact the procedural due process issues, and I don't believe the appellant should be heard to say, well, there must have been bias just because the actions were so bad. I think that's an unfair causation argument. And there wasn't any evidence, there isn't any evidence in the record that any of the decision makers were biased. Moving over to the substantive due process issues, again, the limited scope is mentioned in the brief. I won't repeat the issues that are raised there. What I heard appellants argue today, and what I think has been a focus of this case, is the suggestion that as a result of this expulsion, MR couldn't get an education. And I think that that is inaccurate on the facts and also as a matter of law. Certainly, there are a whole host of other educational options that were available. And in fact, the school wrote to MR's mother, the plaintiff in this case, and identified the specific options that were available.
There can't be many private schools who would bid for students with his record, however.
Well, there were four or five different options that were listed, and these were not, you know, ones that were taken off the internet with no thought. These are, and I can list them from the record, these are schools and entities that will accept and do accept people have been expelled from other schools. But I don't want to shortchange the issue of public education here. Because
this kind of reason?
Well, generally. This type of reason, I meant expulsion, not what's surrounded and the reasons for the expulsion here. But there are entities that will take expelled students in a private matter. But I don't want to undersell the right to a public education, although I don't think it makes an issue of substantive due process. I do want the record to be clear that MR was not precluded from seeking a public paid-for education in the state of Wisconsin. What his expulsion lost for him was the opportunity for the Burlington Area School District to educate him. But he had the opportunity to seek education at any other district in the state of Wisconsin paid. Would it have happened? Let me anticipate your question. I don't know. Would another district have taken him in? No one knows. The reason we don't know is because no effort was made to do that. But if we go back to the letter that was sent to MR's parents, that was one of the options. That was the sixth and final option that was given. You can go to another public school in the state of Wisconsin and attempt to get a public education. Was that done? There's no evidence in the record that that was done. And again, whether or not he could have received a public education or not, I don't think is pertinent or dispositive of the substantive due process issue. I think that this is not a due process issue. The expulsion was rationally related to a vital state interest in providing a safe environment that's conducive to learning. And certainly having this participant in this scheme, and there's been no suggestion that there wasn't a participation. It's clear that there was participation in the plot. Having that person in the schools would have been uproarious at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Milcher.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Anything further, Mr. Nunnery?
I think it's very, very important. There is nothing in this record regarding he can go to another school. In fact, when there is an expulsion order in one public school and you try to transfer, that expulsion order has to be cleared. So having an expulsion order in Burlington, he couldn't go anywhere, but that's not in the record. Either of his attorneys, he used that expression, he did not have attorney Nunnery as an attorney of record at the time of the hearing. So he did not have another attorney. The TRO was, in fact, in place at the time of the hearing. The open-mindedness issue of the board, Mr. Anderson, the president of the board, knew he had withdrawn from the plot. Mr. Anderson, the president of the board,
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. Court will be in recess until tomorrow.